Ms. Hall was found at the end of a dead-end street, and she had a severe post-mortem mutilation of her body. And she was placed under a sign that said, dead-end.
It was obvious to police that this was no typical murder. The number of stab wounds, the viciousness with which she was attacked, all indicated that the person who had done this was full of rage toward women.
Her remains were not covered up. She'd been there for some time. There was a jacket on near her right hand. And once you get up close and start examining her remains, you can see that both of her hands had been severed and removed at the wrist. The manner of death, which we've identified as a strangulation, ligature marks were identified. And now you're thinking back to your Catherine Hall victim, where the postmortem cutting and some dismemberment took place.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler, and currently writer and producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today in studio is...
Laura Richards, advocate, analyst and author, and also director and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds and Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. And I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. And happy end of the season, Jim, for Criminal Minds. We just wrapped season 12. We had our party last night. We'll be posting pictures.
It was fun.
It was great. It was great to see everybody in one place. And it's kind of amazing when you think about it. 12 seasons of Criminal Minds. In the history of television, there are very few shows that have made it that long. So
congratulations.
I want to thank all of our watchers and listeners for being great fans of the show.
Yeah, it's really you guys that make this possible. There was one question from one of our listeners that has to do with Criminal Minds, so can I shoot it to you real quick?
Sure.
So a couple podcasts ago, we talked about geographic profiling and database profiling. So our listener, Michelle, has developed a theory from watching Criminal Minds that serial killers have a kill and disposal zone shaped like a donut. The center is their main base, like home and work, and the outer ring is the furthest they're willing to travel to find or dispose of a victim. Does this theory hold water? If so, can it be used to focus investigations, or would it place unnecessary blinders on an investigation?
Well, that's a very good theory, and I think it probably does look like a very misshapen donut. They have zones that they create from geographic profiling. It's actually a very complicated algorithm that Kim Rossmo came up with. He trained a couple of the profilers that were in the behavioral analysis unit when I was working there. But it would be sort of like a donut if you put it on a frying pan and didn't really know how to cook one. Because basically, it wouldn't be a very regular geometric shape. And there's a lot to do with where the streets go, where there are rural areas, transportation modalities. There's all sorts of factors. But you can think about it theoretically as a donut, because the hole would be the place around their home where they wouldn't want to be too close to home, because they wouldn't want to lead police back to them.
So you get some killers who are criminally sophisticated, but many of them start out, as we know, you know, in terms of the geographic spread, their hunting grounds tend to be their anchor points, so the places that they would be on their day-to-day without arousing suspicion.
Between where they live and where they work.
Or maybe where they play sport, or, you know, and these are what we would call anchor points. Mm-hmm. So the geographic profiling system works on that basis of looking at offences to link them, but also, once we understand an offender, what we tend to understand is that they will be in their initial hunting ground around those places that they're most comfortable in, looking at the victim pool. And then as they continue to offend, then they start to move out.
Right.
So that's why it could look almost like a donut in some respects. But mm-hmm. of course, it depends what measures and lengths somebody goes to avoid detection.
Right. And I think another important factor is whether the offender has one primary offense location, one crime scene, or whether he abducts from one place, brings to another place to commit crimes, and then disposes of the body in a third place. And all those factors are brought into this algorithm. And so it's a very complicated formula to determine really where his zone of operation is, his hunting zone, his disposal zone, and probably his living zone as well.
Yeah, and they all can be very different. But of course, with the case that we're discussing at the moment, what we understand of, you know, certainly the last few cases we've been discussing, they're very localized. You know, they're all in very specific areas and, you know, in areas where the links should have been made through behavior first and foremost, but then, of course, through forensics. So it's a good point to talk about,
right,
going back to the case that we've been discussing.
Right. So whereas the first victim, Ann Bryan, of this particular killer, SG, was aged 81, and she was murdered on March 21st, 1994. The next known victim is Catherine Hall, and she was aged 29 at the time she was murdered. And that was on January 4th, 1999, 5 years later.
This is in North Baton Rouge, so we're talking about the Baton Rouge area.
Yes, we're still talking about the Baton Rouge killings. And so this was a very different situation. In fact, Catherine Hall was out in public screaming that somebody had taken her baby. And under the ruse of helping her find her baby, he actually picked her up and ended up killing her. So a totally different set of circumstances. He took advantage of somebody who was vulnerable. In the first case, Ann Bryan, who was in a retirement home, minding her own business. And then in this next case with Catherine Hall, he took advantage of her because she was frantic looking for her baby.
But she was not really looking for her baby, though. I think she was mentally disturbed, and he saw that, and that's why he preyed upon her.
She is a sex worker.
Yeah. For whatever reason, Catherine Hall was actually out in public screaming that she had lost her baby, and whether that was some kind of delusion on her part or whatever, she may have been mentally unstable, but he took advantage of the situation and got her into his car. And that was the last time she was seen alive.
And I believe he lured her into the car on the premise of oral sex. That, you know, and again, in terms of when we think about risk, you know, she was a sex worker, as were a number of the women that he targeted. And in terms of risk, obviously, that puts some of the victims here in the high risk zone in terms of their victimology. But of course, it's not what we're saying in terms of blaming or attributing anything in particular because of something, you know, that someone is or what somebody does. But in terms of his access levels, you know, some women, he managed to get into the car on the premise that, you know, it's an exchange and that he's going to give them money for sex effectively. But she does try to fight him off and tries to escape him. Right. And I think it's in this case, for the first time, that he uses a zip tie, which he had actually called the objectifier. And in his mind, in terms of what he says on his interview, that he had perfected using it because it was an object and something he would use in his everyday work, but he could explain it away if he was ever asked why did he have them on him. He could say it's because of, you know, where he worked and being at the convenience store, that he could easily explain it away.
Right, and he expected to be stopped at some point by police officers and questioned, so this was something that he had as part of his job, so he thought that this was a perfect killing tool for him. And calling it the objectifier reveals this is what we would call leakage. In other words, it actually tells us a lot more about his personality. The objectifier, meaning this is the tool that he takes a woman and turns her into an object. By killing her with this tool, she now becomes his plaything. And this is one of the things that I was talking about earlier about how heinous this particular offender was, how completely, totally devoid of human empathy he was, and how psychopathic he was, that he literally just thought efficiency was the most important thing. The thing that he wanted to do was kill somebody, so that then he would be able to play with them. And this case was really reprehensible, what he did. But he stabbed Catherine Hall 16 times before she died and 21 times after she died. This would be similar to what he did with Anne Bryan. Multiple stab wounds, both pre and post-mortem. But he also cut up her body pretty extensively and actually was fascinated by the pearly white color of her bones. And that just tells you how sick this and demented this guy is, that he had this fascination, this curiosity about what people looked like on the inside. And he didn't care that he's killing somebody and cutting their open to find out. And it's just most human beings don't have that capacity. He didn't have the capacity to care about human beings. He didn't give a damn about anybody else but himself.
And he didn't want the interaction. And I think, you know, that's another important part. And, you know, with him specifically, which is very idiosyncratic to him, mm-hmm. and, you know, the paraphilias that he has. But he's not seeking intimacy. He's not seeking interaction. He actually wants them to be lifeless,
right.
and objects so that he can then do an experiment with them,
right.
effectively. And like you said, play with them almost, you know, doll-like.
Right. And that's a perfect intro to necrophilia. And so necrophilia is basically the sexual attraction to a dead body and engaging in sexual activities with a dead body. It doesn't have to be traditional sex, as we might call it, but it can very well be traditional sex. In other words, sorry for the graphic nature of this, but raping a dead body, basically, as well as other kind of fetish behaviors with body parts. So how did this happen that this particular offender, SG, developed necrophilia?
Well, I think it's, you know, paraphilias are always interesting to understand, you know, what it is, because there are so many different ones. So things like paedophilia would be classed as a paraphilia.
Right.
So, and frotterism is a paraphilia. So there's lots of different types of behaviours.
What's frotterism?
So frotterism is where, you know, I'll use the tube in London, for example, where you're stood on the tube or the subway in New York and somebody's rubbing up and down or behind you. In close
body.
Intimacy contact.
Oh, I just call those perverts. I mean, yeah. That's my...
Well, frotterism. Yeah, but frotterism is the actual paraphilia, and paraphilias in general are a sexual attraction to an inanimate object or a non-consenting party. So that's what a general paraphilia is. So frotterism is when you get off on the thought of rubbing up against somebody sexually in a place where you're kind of forced to be close to each other, like in a packed subway. And then, you know, there's any number. I mean, there are many, many, many paraphilias, and necrophilia happens to be one of the most extreme ones.
And cannibalism,
which we'll find that SG does
experiment with.
Yeah, in this...
With different victims.
In this case, yeah.
So it's important just to explain that, because there are lots, you know, anything that's sort of not within the normal, and I say normal with my inverted commas, you know, the normal sexual encounter script or sexual intimacy script. And probably Jim and I have, you know, certainly worked on, advised on a large number of cases where you see... you know, various paraphilias. You know, the challenge of even saying paedophilia, which is a paraphilia, you know, the Latin translation is love of the child or children. So actually some of the terminology I struggle with. You know, in terms of when you're writing reports, you obviously have to use the formal terminology.
Right. And in this context, paedophilia, what it is a sexual attraction to children. And that is actually sexual attraction to children who have not yet reached puberty. And so there's also hebephilia and ephebophilia, which are the sexual attraction to male and female children between who are post-puberty but still under the age of 18. So there are many varied paraphilias, and this guy happens to have a number of them. And it even gets more bizarre. But
going back to his childhood, I think there's an interesting point to understand, which explains some of these things, is that he spent a lot of time when he was growing up in a funeral parlour. So who's he exposed to in funeral parlours? Dead bodies that he starts to become intrigued by, and, you know, did things like, you know, sleeping in the coffins and touching the dead bodies. And actually, you know, this seems to be the basis, really, of his interest. And of course, you know, the fantasy starts to, there are seeds of it there.
And I think what he's probably not disclosing is the fact that in the privacy at this funeral home, that he started developing fantasies, sexual fantasies about the bodies that were in there. And he most likely started masturbating to reinforce that arousal pattern. And it culminated in him killing women and then continuing that sexual fantasy with the dead bodies.
And the levels of violence and also with pornography, which he had shown, I believe, to Terry. You know, there was no secret in some senses to the level of the violence that he was into in the pornography that he was viewing. And he was at his computer a lot. And Terry was appalled by it, but she didn't challenge him on it. And so when she talks about having a non-sexual relationship with him, it starts to make sense that the usual sort of sexual intimacy is the thing that does not arouse him. So he's using other people and being able to have that time to spend when Terry's out the home, which is why she never challenges him on these things. Mm-hmm. She just turns a blind eye because she doesn't really want to face the reality of what's going on, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So we're only up to the first two victims yet. With Anne Bryan, he killed her where she lived, and there was no paraphilia there. Catherine Hall, he killed her out in the street.
Well, hang on, there is a paraphilia.
Oh, there is.
Because we would call it gerontophilia, because she is an 81-year-old female.
Ah.
Now, bearing in mind he's going into a nursing home and he's been watching her and he's aroused by that.
It's the sexual attraction to an old woman.
Right.
And that also can be, I mean, obviously he went in there with a knife and he said, I thought I would just rape her. So it's very obvious that he went in there with bad intentions and with a sexual attraction to that woman. So that's why it's paraphilic.
Right.
I mean, it's not paraphilic normally to be for anybody to be sexually attracted to an older woman, but to force yourself on a non-consenting older woman, that's a paraphilia.
Right. I was just trying to track sort of his development and evolution. So the first two victims, you know, he went to a certain extent, and it wasn't, and then he started getting different in what he did, bringing them home with him, and we haven't gotten to those yet. But
he diversifies. But there are, you know, every case is unique in its own way, and this one is, in a sense, because there are so many paraphilic behaviours, and actually tracking it, you know, for me, the Anne Bryan case is, you know, is this the first case? Well, it's the first one that we know about, but it's an extreme thing to do for him to be stalking and watching, you know, an elderly female and to be hyper aroused by it and then act out the rape and then that level of violence, for there not to be anything prior to that. I find that incredibly hard to believe.
Mm-hmm.
But the diversification in terms of, you know, the MO and the types of victims, the ages of them and what he does, the evolution of his, you know, the spectrum of offending is very interesting, you know, over a time period. So you're right to try and make sense of that. But sometimes it's very difficult to make any sense of behaviours and choices, you know, of some offenders. And we will try and put them in neat boxes. But actually, in my experience, when you do that, you call it wrong because, you know, only that individual knows everything they're doing and why they're doing it. But certainly there are some things about him taking someone back with him to his home space, because that's an environment that you can control. And if you want to spend time with your object, the thing that, you know, it's almost like going out hunting and killing, bringing someone back and being able to control your environment, because he knows Terry's away and it allows him the space to do his experiments and everything that he wants to do.
Right. And I think on that note, I mean, if Terry had gotten sick and come home early, I think her life would have been over. I think he would have killed her without even thinking about it. She was just sort of a beard and a mask for him, and convenient.
And she was probably paying for the house, and she was probably paying expenses and everything because, you know,
she legitimizes everything for him. Mm-hmm. And if she, that sounds right in terms of the things that he cannot control, then we would probably see some very different behaviors, and she would be at risk.
Mm-hmm. So, but before we leave the Catherine Hall case, I think it's really important to note another bit of leakage behavior on his part, and that is that he deposited the body, he dumped her body at the end of a dead end, and it's a sign at the end of this dead end that says dead end, and he literally thought it was funny. He said that, he said he laughed when he put her there, and that he said it was funny, the poetry of it, and it gave him a rush. He thought it was wonderful. So he was not only toying with her as a human being, but he was toying with law enforcement or whoever would find this body. And he said it basically made him God. So he had a God complex, which you can add to the list of other mental disorders that he had, but that he willingly participated in. He willingly pursued this. He fantasized about it over and over again. This is not something that he had to act on. He could clearly act what we'll say in inverted commas normal. He could have a relationship with a person and treat people with respect and use his good speaking skills and his personality to get close to people. He was capable of doing that. But that's not what his fantasy life was about. His fantasy life was totally about taking advantage of people, doing things to give him an opportunity to play with dead people and their body parts.
All about choice. You know, and that's why violence and abuse is all about choice rather than, you know, something that you cannot control, choosing who to be violent and abusive to and who not. And I think, you know, certainly this kind of message that he's sending law enforcement or whoever sees her body, which was posed naked underneath the sign, and again, that was for effect. You know, he's sending a very clear message, and he certainly at this stage had no real concerns about the forensics, you know, about the police finding the body. And DNA was actually found. And unfortunately, at this time, they had no suspect.
Right. No, nobody to check the DNA again.
People begin locking their doors, locking their windows. Women begin taking self-defense classes. There was such a range between the types of women that were killed that no one was safe, and Baton Rouge became paralyzed with fear.
So between the first and second known victims, there was a 5-year gap. But between the second and third victims, there was only a 5-month gap. And that is an incredible acceleration. The next victim was Hardy Schmidt, and she was age 52, about the middle between his first two victim ages, and she was murdered on May 30th, 1999. In fact, they had no evidence to tie him to this crime. The investigation didn't discover anything that pointed them to him, which, again, it's just... I don't know. It's just amazing that after having two women killed, I mean, violently, chopped up, basically stabbed multiple times, and just left there, discarded in Catherine Hall's case, and just left at the scene of the crime in Ann Bryant's case, it should have raised all sorts of alarm bells.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, Hardy Schmidt is 52 years of age, and she's blonde. She's a very different profile in terms of the victimology. She was a prominent member of the community, and she lived in the affluent side of town, married to an attorney, and had 3 children. So the profile straight away looks and feels quite different, and he had been, this is by his own admission, so of course, you know, again, you know, we take things you know, in the round, when listening to an individual, certainly one like him with narcissism and wanting to claim things that weren't necessarily proven in terms of facts and evidence and corroborated, but it appears that he had seen her before and he had been stalking her and over a number of weeks, and he sort of knew her running routine, and she was out running that day and she was actually hit with the car. He uses the car initially as the weapon,
right,
and which renders her unconscious. And then he says he didn't know what to do. Well, I find that, again, if this were one of his victims, highly questionable, because he seemed to have the items, the zip ties and other things that he'd brought with him. And he used them on Hardy, and he also raped her. And then, interestingly, he leaves her in the, what I would call the boot of the car, the trunk of the car.
For 2 days.
For 2 days. And he goes off to pick up Terry again. He goes off to pick Terry up from work, and she's actually in the boot of the car.
Mm-hmm. So that's some kind of a rush for him to know that?
Yeah, it's the risk. It's the thrill-seeking behavior. This is very common in psychopaths. They get bored easily, and they do things that are exciting and risky, and that's why you see his crimes are very high risk. And this victim, Artie Schmidt, I mean, she was jogging like she was every day.
Broad daylight. This happened in broad daylight.
Yes. And
so extremely high risk. I mean, she's a high risk victim, and it could be seen by anybody coming upon that path at that time and that day. And for her to just disappear would, again, you would expect alarm bells to be ringing.
Right. And there is some confusion, or at least some argument, that perhaps he didn't commit this crime because he says he used the zip tie, but when they did recover her body, they didn't find any evidence of strangulation. Now, she wasn't recovered right away, and she was put into a swampy area, so that could have deteriorated away. So I'm not sure that is a actual fact.
But they said the blow to the head is what killed her,
right,
not the ligature, is what I had read.
Right.
So the cause of death was the blow to the head via the car, potentially.
Yeah, or he could have hit her after he hit her with the car if she had regained consciousness or whatever. But the fact is that he raped her after she was dead. And again, paraphilia, necrophilia. So this guy has some really serious, violent sexual fantasies that he's able to control and only do them when he's with somebody he intends to kill.
So then he disposes of her body in a park near a bayou on Highway 61.
And interestingly, Terry did ask him what there was a smell in the car when she was picked up. And so she does ask him a question about that.
And he says, oh, I ran over a squirrel earlier. It must have stuck underneath the car. I'll make sure I go wash the car. And that's when he disposes of the body in this swampy area.
So June the 5th, I believe the body was found. So from May 30th, 1999 to June 5th, she's missing. So, and then you have a five-month gap until the next victim.
And the next victim is Joyce Williams. She was age 36 at the time she was murdered in January of 2000.
And this is a case, you know, this one in particular with Joyce, Jim, that I remember that kind of stood out, you know, amongst the others because of what he said about her legs, you know, that he had seen her and picked her up and took her, well, basically managed to get her into the car. But he said, you know, in recalling it, he said, those legs, she had beautiful legs, and I just had to have those legs.
Yeah. So further objectifying women. And this will be the first of many indications that he literally looked at women not as human beings, but as a collection of body parts that he would be fascinated with. Again, another fetish behavior or paraphilic behavior is to be sexually attracted to an inanimate object. So he didn't look at the women as a whole and say, I'm sexually attracted to that woman. He looked at pieces of them and said, I'm sexually attracted to those pieces. And whether that's the legs or the hands or some other body part, it's a totally different experience than what most humans experience.
Right. And so this is the first time that we understand that he takes someone back to the house and he takes Joyce back and he then dismembers her. But in particular, you know, the reference to she had lovely legs, he dismembers her and he actually consumes, he eats a part of her leg. This is where we first understand the cannibalism and the fantasy, the sexual aspect to it, but that he doesn't want an interaction. He's not looking for an interaction with the victim. Right. It's not necessarily the kill part that is the thing for him. It's about the kill is functional to be able to get to this interaction and the spending time.
So other killers would be interested in seeing their terror and enjoying them
that
begging
would be
for their
sadistic
life.
Oh, okay. Killer.
Gotcha. Yeah.
That's not him at all. He's a necrophilic killer. And he actually said during the law enforcement interview after he was caught that there were times when he was hunting and he was hoping that he would find somebody else's victim, because there were other serial killers operating at the time. He would love to find a victim that somebody already killed, not because he cared about killing another person, but it's just more convenient. If he could find a dead person, then he could do whatever he wanted, and he wouldn't have to go through the whole thing about being nice to the person to get him into his car, and then killing them, and then having to move the body. He could just do what he wanted wherever he found the victim.
And I think that, you know, that was an interesting thing that he said, but I'm not altogether sure I believe what he says there, because when we look back at some of the behaviours in terms of what he actually does, you know, some of these cases is real extreme overkill. I mean, the amount of times that he's stabbing post-mortem,
right,
and the exploratory stuff that he's doing, I'm just not sure, you know. And he talked about hunting, that he enjoyed the hunting part of,
right,
and watching and the voyeurism. And, you know, I think this is someone who's really into this power and control, and that power and control dynamic, you know, giving that he feels he's in ultimate control. I think that's what he's seeking, the ultimate control. But, you know, some of the other things he says on interview, you know, is about the hunting aspect and
right,
having a perfect hunt, capture, kill method.
Right.
And that's what he was trying to perfect. I think he was trying to almost, you know, sound better than what he was, and trying to sort of almost, you know, big himself up in a sense. And then at other times say things to shock people.
I think the man is clearly self-interested. Narcissism just oozes out of this guy. And, you know, we'll see in some of his future victims, there's more of his extreme behavior coming out. One of the things that he had said in this case was that as soon as he tasted the flesh, he spit it right out. And again, I don't know if that is true either. I think he probably didn't want to be labeled a cannibal, but clearly he had a desire and a curiosity about what it would taste like. And just reprehensible and disgusting, and I'm sorry for being so graphic about it, but the fact is that he definitely did not give, I mean, just the slightest thought about other human beings.
And just even the way that he said, you know, those legs, I just had to have those legs, as if he's talking right, about ordering chicken in a restaurant.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the level that we're at here. And, you know, he dismembers her in his own kitchen using the knives that he and Terry would cook with.
Right.
And then, you know, so you just think about that in the context that he's taken her back and using the utensils they would use in everyday living, and then cleans up the kitchen and goes.
Terry comes home and thinks, oh, wow, he cleaned the house. How nice.
Yeah.
And clearly that should have been a behavioural cue. You know, if he's not somebody who would clean the house or do things around the house, that something isn't quite right.
And just before we move on, I just want to, you know, remind people that she was not a piece of meat. You know, that Joyce, while she had, it seems that she had fallen into addiction and prostitution before that, she had attended Southern University for 2 years. She loved to sing and dance and, you know, was a real person before he got his hands on her. So I just wanted to shout that out.
Thank you. Lillian Robinson was the next victim of this killer. She was 52 years old, and she was found by fishermen. She had been abducted in January of 2000.
So Lillian was African American. The reports have said that she was a prostitute, but other things that I have on her is that she attended church regularly, very close to her two sisters. But apparently she was picked up by SG in North Baton Rouge.
So this was another case that the police had absolutely no evidence to tie SG to this murder. But we know that he, by his confession, that he brought her home to his house and that he played with the body after she was dead. This indicates to me, Laura, I want to see if you agree, that he has absolutely no self-confidence, that his personality was such that he may have pretended like he was a confident person, but he couldn't function sexually unless the person was actually dead. He could not actually face another human being and put up with interacting with another human being.
I'd agree with that. I think he's actually quite a pathetic individual. You know, the level of sort of the self-esteem and sense of self and actually wanting to have no interaction at all, you know, nothing or no one to challenge him. He's God in his own world. And I think that aspect of him saying, you know, he is God, he's the ultimate decision taker and in control. Yes, he's in control because he has silenced these women forever. Sure. He likes the idea of sort of setting himself up in these interviews as a hunter of women. But of course, at least five of them were sex workers and were vulnerable, and he lures them into his car. This isn't someone who is doing, you know, extraordinary things to capture women. He is exploiting vulnerability, and he's incredibly pathetic in terms of the way that he conducts himself. And I mean that because he really wants to be seen as some kind of, you know, a man who people should fear and did these terrible things. But I think a lot of it is about trying to get reaction and respect from people.
'Cause he does it after they're dead. He does all these horrific things. And I think that is, again, an indicator of low self-confidence and an intent to try to make himself to be bigger and badder than he really is.
Right, and these women, you know, he sees, in terms of his victims, you know, as dolls, and they cannot answer back. And that's the point to it, that he is in ultimate control with them, you know, and then he can do whatever he wants to them in terms of, you know, taking body parts and... you know, with Lillian in particular, he treats her like a doll. And interestingly here, he doesn't dismember her, which again, just comes down to a time issue because Terry's due to return home. So again, when we think about offender decision-making, sometimes it's just on a practical level that they can't carry out and do all the things that they would want to do because somebody else, you know, appears and they're on the clock that they need to have, you know, for him, he's taken her home. And so he can't do all the things that he probably would have wanted to.
Right. And it also is kind of indicative of the fact that he many times went after women who were older than him is part and parcel to the fact that he actually had sexual fantasies about his mother. Now, his father was brutal and pointed a gun at him when he was a kid and said he was going to kill him and things like that, and he eventually was thrown out of the house or just left, and the mother raised SG alone. But he definitely fantasized about her, and he thought, when she was getting older, he actually built these fantasies about, well, if she had died, then he would play dress-up with her and do things to her and put her in different situations. Another paraphilia and another indicator of just what kind of a sick dude this guy was.
Well, there was also a report that his father had found... you know, and his father suffered from mental disorders, and so there's this history of abuse and violence too in the home, but that his father had found gay pornography and him looking at that and had challenged him and was appalled and disgusted by it. So I think that there probably was some kind of exchange, possibly a violent one, about, you know, and that insight, you know, that it may have been men that he was interested in,
right.
but his father's reaction, and therefore we see all these repressed, it's almost like a repressed behaviour in terms of, you know, the hatred of women, but being very meek and mild to them as well, as right. well as to men in authority.
Right, and it could be that this was just one other example of his sort of curiosity about sex and not actually being able to interact with human beings, but just fantasizing about things that were, you know, non-interactive, him being able to do whatever he wanted to another human being. So the next victim is Marilyn Nevels. She was 38 when she was murdered in October of 2000. So already in the space of 1 year, he's got three victims. Again, this is an acceleration. Usually there was a 5 year gap at first and then 2 5-month gaps. And now he's killing three women in the space of 1 year. Shouldn't this have had every law enforcement agency within reach scouring the neighborhoods, I mean, trying to figure out who the hell did this? But again, with Marilyn Nevels, there was no actual evidence found that linked him to the crime.
So Marilyn was Caucasian. She is described as being a sex worker, but it looks like that she fought back and escaped him for a brief bit before he could kill her with a rebar or some kind of pipe, not his normal zip tie technique.
Yeah, she got away and he was had to find something on the spur of the moment to actually do the deed.
So which points to the fact this could probably be, you know, possibly be more opportunistic, that he sees somebody and he decides to take that opportunity. But he does take her back to the home address and or his home address, and he takes a shower with her.
Yeah. Again, this is the kind of thing that somebody who has a paraphilia of necrophilia might do, because he's building a fantasy about interacting with a dead body. He's not building a fantasy about interacting with a human being. He's has this fantasy in his mind about somebody who's completely not interactive because they're dead, and that sexually turns him on.
And doing an everyday thing with, you know, somebody, like taking a shower with them,
right.
but this is a dead body. So it really is fascinating in terms of how he's trying to, you know, take someone to his home address, but doing everyday things with them and testing out and exploring all these things.
Mm-hmm.
But then he disposes of her body, actually leaves it sat out in the open.
Mm-hmm.
So blatant disregard for the victim, naked, and the shock factor of being found, sending a message again.
Yeah, and I think he really wanted to sort of compete with the publicity that other serial killers in the neighborhood were getting, and that's why he did leave her out in the open, to shock and scare the community.
I wanted to ask you guys about a fetish that actually we did an episode on Criminal Minds, I think my first year on the show, about a man who orders limbs in the mail and is prosthetic limbs and eventually real limbs in order to have sex with those limbs. What is that about? Can you talk about that at all? Or,
well, it's very similar to this guy.
Right. I mean, that's what made me think of it.
Yeah. That,
so.
He objectifies women to the point where they are a collection of body parts, not actually people. And so they focus on one particular area that they like. It becomes a fetish. It becomes a paraphilia. They are sexually aroused only by that part. So they don't need the rest of the person. They don't want the rest of the person. Mm-hmm. The rest of the person interferes with their fantasy about this inanimate object.
Mm-hmm.
And so hopefully you can't understand that, and hopefully our listeners can't understand that, because they fall in love with actual people and they're sexually attracted to real human beings.
With a real interaction and a real connection and a real intimacy level.
Right.
Right.
But this doesn't happen just genetically or overnight. This is done in the privacy of his own brain, thousands and thousands of fantasies that he builds up, masturbates to reinforce that arousal pattern so that he actually gets sexually aroused by this thing.
And so it is something that he participated in the development of. It didn't just happen to him.
Yeah. I guess I'm just sort of pushing back a little bit on people who might have a foot fetish, or if it isn't an inanimate artificial limb fetish. I mean, there are healthy fantasy lives, you know, that don't necessarily lead to murder. So you're looking at me like I'm crazy, but I just,
I feel
maybe it's because of that previous writer who felt like we were judging people on a certain extent. Like there is healthy fantasy worlds that don't lead people to become murderers.
Yes, but if that fetish is about a sexual attraction to an inanimate object or a non-consenting party, it is a mental disorder.
Okay,
so
right, but that's
don't, yeah, but the things you just described are those things. So no, if you have a foot fetish as part of a human being, in other words, you like to engage with somebody who has feet and who you're interacting with in a sexual way, and that's an erogenous zone for that person, that's fine. But when you're thinking only of the foot and you don't care about the fact that it's attached to a human being, that's when it becomes a mental disorder. And it is not healthy in any way, shape, or form. So the part that is attached to the human body, that's good. But there are also people who fantasize about people who have amputations. And they're still fantasizing about the person.
And
not
the
about
person,
the part
it's
that's
the connection,
chopped off.
Which is why the striking thing for me with Joyce was when he says, I just saw those legs and I just knew I just had to have those legs. It wasn't about who they were connected to. It was just about that the objectification of them and that little insight. So that they are two different things. But there is a, yeah, as Jim described, there's a spectrum. And it's about, you know, if something is an erogenous zone or something that it, and it connects with a person, then it's highly different for if it's a non-consenting, you know, or it's an object.
Right. Because it's just, it becomes an isolating thing if it's just an object or an inanimate object. But it's also a criminal thing if it's a non-consenting party.
Of course. Of
so course. We just have to make sure we make that very strict delineation. If it is activity between two consenting adults and there's fetish behavior, well, that's fine as long as it's not destructive or damaging or hurtful to someone. And it is not exploitive, because we wouldn't want that either. But once it steps across any one of those lines, it goes away from normal healthy behavior and goes into an area that we would not condone.
So an interesting thing happens after he kills Marilyn Nevels, and that's, we know that he was watching the media, but DL is actually arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And that does have an impact on SG.
Right. I think he may have been a little frightened that he could be next. One of the things that probably helped him during his killing career was the fact that the police were sort of spread out among a number of killers at the same time, and so their resources were reduced. And now, having had one of his contemporary killers from the neighborhood caught, he probably figured, I could be next. So he had a 3-year hiatus, at least a 3-year hiatus that we know of bodies that were discovered. And he actually changed up significantly in his victim choice, because his next victim was Johnny Mae Williams. She was 45. She was murdered in October of 2003. But she was very well known to the offender. They actually were, and I'll put this in inverted commas, friends. They had been over each other's houses. He hired her to clean his house. And he had a friendly relationship with her.
And her children.
And her kids.
So with friends like this, who needs enemies?
Good Lord. And so he just decided that one day when he ran into her that this was going to be the day that their last interaction occurred.
I mean, not only that, she invited him to Thanksgiving. I mean, they were, this is disgusting. I mean, that he, and why would he turn to somebody that he knew? I mean, isn't that very risky? Because he should be questioned after her murder. I mean, anybody in her life would have been questioned, right?
Yeah, and I think that this is the kind of mistake that criminals make. I mean, it had been 3 years since we know that he killed somebody. He probably saw an opportunity and didn't think it all the way through because there was probably a body part on her that he had been looking at for years and wanted, and he took the risk.
I think that's probably exactly what happened, that it actually came down to an objectification of a certain thing that mm-hmm. he had been looking at for some time. And whatever happens on this particular day, October 2003, he decides to take this big risk and act on it and uses the necktie, takes her to his home address, but uses the necktie and dismembers her.
Right. Takes off her hands.
Exactly.
And so that must be the object that he wanted. He desired her hands, didn't give a damn about the rest of her, didn't give a damn about her kids, didn't give a damn about their relationship. And what he wanted was her hands.
And what did he do with her hands?
He took her hands and he cleaned them and he put nail polish on them. I mean, he painted her nails. And this is something I think that goes back to when he talked about fantasizing about his mother and dressing her up. I think these are parts of his fantasy life that he didn't want to share with anybody else. He didn't want anybody else to know this. So it was much easier for him to kill the person and not have to reveal these fetishes that he had that may not have been accepted by other people.
And this is his, you know, true psychopathology and probably something he'd been fixating on for some time that, you know, as you said, no one knew about. Mm-hmm. And so in the privacy of his own home, he's got the time to act out. And, you know, if anyone was to say to hedge their bets on what happened next, they probably would never even come up with this is really the reason why he killed her.
Right.
And then he can spend time with parts of her that he wanted, you know, and sort of playing doll almost, as if, well, playing with a doll, but yeah, it's a human being.
She was a mother still, you know, she just had a problem. To me, she was just, you know, great person, great woman. Like, everything that she did, she just gave all her heart and soul to it. You know, she was one of them people that loved deeply.
Well, the last known victim of SG is Donna Bennett Johnston. And she was 43 when she was murdered on February 26, 2004. This woman was treated as if she were a game animal. He went out to hunt, and he was going to find a woman, capture and kill her no matter what. And unfortunately, Donna Bennett Johnston fell into his sights.
Fell into his sights, but there was another aspect, because that's exactly what he said. You know, this was a successful hunt, capture and kill. But one key important detail was that she was very drunk. Mm-hmm. So really, how much of a hunt is this?
Well, it certainly wasn't any kind of a fair fight. I mean, he picked on her because she was very vulnerable. And that ended up, you know, leading to her demise.
And he chases after her. But I think, you know, he tries to make out he's being quite clever and sophisticated in terms of what he's doing. But yes, he certainly had things on him that we know that he went out with that in mind to right. find someone. But to find someone who, you know, is vulnerable and that drunk, it's not going to take too much really to overpower them.
Right. And he thought even though she was drunk, she kind of passed out in his car, didn't she?
Yeah, and then she managed to escape out of the car,
right,
and he goes running after
but
her.
She passed out in the car. He put the choker on her neck and tried to kill her, and she still was able to break away from him. So it was a failure, actually, and he calls this his most successful hunt, right?
The perfect kill,
right.
in inverted commas, which it was not.
It was not, because he's making up fake history. he's reinventing what happened so that he looks better.
The narrative and selling it back. And that's exactly why, you know, when we listen to somebody on interview, you know, checking and corroborating every fact to see whether it actually corresponds to what's being said.
Right.
For him, he has an inflated sense of self and is trying to make himself meaner, badder, you know, and better in terms of his criminal sophistication and actually really what he was.
Right. And what he was disgusting because
and pathetic.
When he did catch up to her and he pulled the thing tighter around her neck, she said, her last words were, "I can't breathe." And he said, "Well, that's the plan." I mean, it just shows you how disgusting he is, how little, I mean, he completely devoid of any caring about any human being. It was all about him. And it was all about his pathetic self trying to feel better about himself. And it's really disgusting, but he also took it one step further and took photographs of her with the thing tight around her neck and, you know, her body and then the things he did to her afterwards.
In fact, there were 42 pictures. So this tells you again also about time spent and the documentation and this kind of, you know, the violent pornography that, you know, is part of his sexual fantasy so that he can live this out after the event. So this is someone who did take souvenirs, who, you know, sometimes the victim was a souvenir, even taking Hardy in the boot of the car or the trunk of the car. But here, you know, he actually went looking for a female, but he also had a hacksaw, a knife and a digital camera. And I believe he took pictures in other cases as well. So he was creating this whole, you know, library documenting what he'd been doing to these women and being able to live throughout that fantasy again and again and again.
I mean, he's just a reprehensible, I don't even want to call him human, but just totally reprehensible. I mean, we know that the whole fantasy that he started building up as a child, prepubescent child in the funeral homes, sleeping in coffins and touching the body parts and so forth, that he started that fantasy behavior then. And that helped him develop. And he must have really tried to hone and reinforce this kind of sexual attraction that would lead him to necrophilia and cannibalism. But he was completely narcissistic. He had no empathy at all and was truly a psychopath.
So in her case, they ended up catching him because he left tire tracks, or they were able to track down
his... forensically, they were able to, they did some good police work at that point and tracked down the 100 plus people who had bought those kinds of tires in that neighborhood, and they all split him up, and one of them knocked on his door, and... you know, he said he had some, quote, plausible explanations for why he might be there at that time. But
she said he went to the toilet. He needed to, in inverted commas, take a leak. So he puts himself at the scene.
But they did collect DNA from him and they sent it in and it matched. And they went back and they arrested him.
But what was strange to me is that they questioned him, took the DNA and sent him home, where they know he lives with a woman, and, you know, the next day they burst in to arrest him. But I was like, aren't they afraid that he's going to do something, you know, as a last, I don't know, like...
Yeah, I remember that, and I remember feeling the same way. And I don't know if they debated whether she was on his side or not. They probably felt like, how could she not be on his side because he's doing all this killing? How could she not know? But... yeah, they did take a risk. I don't think that they protected her fully, and certainly she could have been victimized. In fact, he gets into bed with her that night, and that was unusual. Well, actually, it was early in the morning, right? He usually does not get into bed with her, and so she noticed this was weird, and she's like, all right, what have you done?
So this is where behavioral norms are very interesting to establish.
Stood out to her. And then, you know, all of a sudden the task force busts in.
And she actually says, you know, what have you done this time?
Right.
But, I mean, just to backtrack a little bit, and again, this just comes with a caveat. of a warning that it is graphic. Spending time with Donna Johnston, he actually slashes her using the knife. He's kind of escalated his behaviour in terms of what he does, of slashing her breasts, cutting off her nipple, and actually gouging out her tattoo that's on her right thigh. Whether he's thinking about identification purposes or whether, you know, this is just pure experimentation. But this is somebody who, you know, again, just has absolute disregard for the victims. And it's really, you know, when you look at the sort of the behaviours of the things that have been done, and then I think for the police, when they were knocking on his door and they're seeing this kind of unassuming, very pathetic individual, I'm not sure in their minds they're putting those two, you know, the behaviours together with this guy who's just really pathetic. And, you know, slight build, ordinary. And I think all those things play into, Jim, you know, what does dangerousness look like? Mm. You know, 9 times out of 10, I have heard police colleagues say, when we find him, we will know. Mm. You know, we'll know him when we see him. And I always think...
No, most of the time in these long-term serial killer cases, the person who actually is committing the crimes has actually already been talked to by the police at some point. Because there is some crossover with between them and their offender pool.
So I think that's probably why it's a high-risk decision, because he could have ended up killing her, then killing himself or absconding, but actually he doesn't. He then very meek and mild behaves in this way, didn't go to his computer, which is what she said he normally would do, right. i.e. probably to view the violent and pornographic content right. while she's sleeping. But instead he gets into bed knowing really, you know, the game is afoot, and is probably unsurprised when the SWAT team come through the house and throw a smoke grenade. I mean, they really went full force to arrest this dangerous individual who was very meek and mild, actually quite effeminate as well when you look at the footage.
Yeah, I have seen some of his video. Yeah.
The two things are quite incongruent.
It almost seemed to me, I don't know if you agree, that he was almost ready to... give up. I mean, he didn't try to flee. He didn't really, at least the interviews that I've seen of him, I don't want to, you know, obviously talk about him too much, but he just seemed like very proud and wanting to talk about it and relive it.
And you've just hit the nail on the head. You know, those things were important to him. He wanted to talk about it. He wanted to own it. He wanted to be seen as the person who had done these things. Talking about it, which is part of the fantasy, reliving it, no doubt, wanting to see pictures, and, you know, is cooperating with law enforcement, and all of those things. You can see his enjoyment
right.
on interview.
And what does a serial killer look like? Well, this particular one, as you said, he looked meek and mild. He was charming. He could be very polite. He could talk people into getting into his car. That wasn't a problem. But the real killer, what he was incredibly narcissistic and totally lacked empathy. He was psychopathic and necrophiliac and cannibalistic. And he engaged in high-risk behavior because of the thrill. And he wanted things, and he took them. And he wanted to play God, so he killed people. He was one of the most disgusting killers that I've ever studied in my career and consulted on cases with in my career. And it's just, there is also a little sadistic component in that, for example, with the last victim, when she said, I can't breathe. And he's like, well, that's the plan. I mean, duh. You know, and then the fact that he dumps one of the victims by a dead end sign, and he thought it was funny. And poetic, you know, just a disgusting excuse for a human.
And he did these things, you know, in my view, because he could. You know, no one stopped him at any point. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when it was up in terms of he knew that, and he did nothing really to evade being caught, you know, again, he wants to take the power and control back. He's the one sat there lauding sort of the details and feeling like he's in control again. And this is all about taking ultimate control. So I think, you know, the levels of manipulation and just that whole interaction, law enforcement, him thinking that he's being respected because of these things that he's done. And you can see his enjoyment at, you know, the intention that he's receiving and claiming. you know, again, there's some question mark about Hardy Schmidt, whether he did actually kill her, but he claims it. You know, he claims, he confesses to three of them. The police don't even really pressure him. He can't wait to tell them all about it.
Right.
So it's a very different kind of psychology. But like I said, I use the word pathetic intentional because he really is a very pathetic individual that is made up through all the self-harm and self-loathing that he has for himself. But he's allowed to do these things. He gets away with it. And he's not really criminally sophisticated. And he's kind of having a laugh and a joke about these things as well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that wraps up our coverage of the victims of this killer SG, and it also wraps up our series on the Bayou killings. We really appreciate the listeners spending this time with us because we wanted to bring back the voice of these many dozens of victims that all died in a very small geographic area over a period of time that was just unprecedented in U.S. history for the number of serial killers operating in one area at any given time.
And I know at we will be talking about another series of murders that happened in Jennings that has come to be known as the Jennings 8 or the Jefferson Davis 8. However, the question is, were those murders actually done by a serial killer? And
right.
So there's kind of a flipped script going on there that we will get to in a future episode. But yeah, this is...
And we appreciate the listeners for getting in touch with people who knew the victims and getting in touch with us about that. And we encourage our listeners to do that with all the cases that we covered, because anything more that we can learn about these victims just helps to give them a little bit more of their voice back.
So we're going to switch gears just before we sign off, because we do have some recs that we want to share with you. Who wants to go first? Jimmy, you want to go first?
Do you want me to go first?
Jay Clem, what do you got for us?
Jay Clem. I have a new book by my colleague and friend, Jim Fitzgerald, and his first book is A Journey to the Center of the Mind, Book One, and his second book is, surprisingly, A Journey to the Center of the Mind, Book Two, The Police Years. And it's a riveting account of his time as a police officer in Bensalem, Pennsylvania. Small town, but some of the crimes that he was able to solve were fascinating. Of course, that led to him then becoming an FBI agent and an FBI profiler. And I was fortunate enough to work with Jim throughout those years that he was in the FBI. So book three will be coming after that, and that'll be talking about his FBI years.
So Fitz is one of our great friends, and I actually haven't read the book yet, Jim C., so I'm looking forward to getting a copy. And I, of course, have heard all about it and there's mm-hmm. certain extracts that he and I have discussed.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm looking forward to reading it. So I'm going to switch slightly in terms of not a book, but more a TV show I've been watching on Netflix that I've got into recently, although it's been around for a little while, and it's called Peaky Blinders. And I don't know if either of you have seen Peaky Blinders.
I started to watch it, and it was I was too tense. Like, I had to turn it off.
Tense times.
I saw it, but I have to tell you, I had trouble following. I think there were a lot of people who were mumbling. Like
the accents, that's what got you.
There's a lot of accents in it because it's set in Birmingham.
Yeah, and they so the combination of the accents and the mumbling, I couldn't follow it. And
put the subtitles on, Jim C., because it is cracking.
Really?
It really is amazing. Once you get into it, you go in deep. I mean, you really...
It's pretty dark, isn't it?
Yeah, but you really submerge yourself. And I have to say, Helen McCrory is superb. I mean, the casting in it is incredible, which is why I wanted to mention it to Lisa and say, you know, if you haven't seen it, do jump into it, because Helen McCrory is Damian Lewis's wife.
I was
wife.
Just going to say that,
yes. And she just is mesmeric. I mean, I am absolutely held by her on screen.
Right.
She's incredible. And then Tom Hardy, who is just...
Say no more.
insanely incredible in it. And then with the cinematography, I mean, the music that they put to it. I mean, I'm in deep. I'm in real deep.
Maybe I'll give it another try. A lot of my friends love that. Yeah, really. So, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
That's cool.
What about you, Lisa?
Okay. The show that I have been binging, and I mean like overnight binging, like 10 hours to get through these seasons.
Wow, you are in deep. I thought I was in deep.
When Oh, it's bad. I know Paul can, you know, he knows when he wakes up in the morning and I'm on the couch and I'm still like.
You haven't moved from the night before.
The Americans.
Really?
Yes.
You know, Tim was the consultant on that show.
I was going to. Yeah. Oh my God, that's so funny you say that, because while I'm watching
it. My brother Tim.
Yeah, so Tim Clemente is. What, ex-FBI, yeah. But international spy. He was an international spy, right? Basically?
Well, no.
Makes him sound like Austin Powers. No. Sorry, we need to take it back to reality.
He worked counterterrorism.
Okay, right. Yeah. So The Americans is in its fifth season. I never watched a single episode of it, and somehow I decided to turn it on, and I could not turn it off. It stars Keri Russell and Matthew Rhys, and they play so many different characters as, you know, spies posing as Americans. They're Soviet spies. But it's so cool because it goes through the history of that time during the Cold War and things that we've forgotten about, how we felt about Russians back then and how our two governments, you know, played this gigantic chess match with each other and right. had counterintelligence going on. And, you know, and I'm sure that it's obviously it's dramatized, but it's just fascinating to see their relationship and how amorphous the morality is and whose side you're on. And Noah Emmerich is also in it. He does an amazing job. So I would really recommend you snuggle in your couch and turn on
like
The Americans.
13-hour sessions.
Oh my gosh, I could not stop.
That's so a serious binge, but I am going to look it. Yes. I am going to look it up, Lisa.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Till next time.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clemente. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.